This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
The Escape Hour, the podcast, is proudly sponsored by La Spaghettata. Over 30 years of food, family, and fun at 238 Lygon Street. Why not try them today? Look for the rainbow flag or call 9663 6102. Visit laspaghettata.com.au or find them on Facebook.
Welcome to The Escape Hour. My name is Tad Lombardo, and our producer and co-host today, Fiona Brooke, will be joining us and is joining us in the studio. The Escape Hour is a show about food and travel, and we've got quite an exciting show today.
We do, Tad. Yeah. It's very exciting because we're traveling to Japan.
Which is the buzzword at the moment, it seems. Everyone you speak with is going to Japan, which is pretty cool.
I know. If Russ was here, he would tell us about how many people book Japan right now.
And can I just say, Russ is on holidays and getting sunburnt in Bali, but we'll deal with him later on that one. And also helping us with paneling is Paul today. Thank you for that.
Thank you, Paul.
And in the studio, we've got two lovely ladies helping us out. We have Alison and Carolyn. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Tad.
Thank you.
You guys have quite an interesting business that started a couple of years ago. Do you want to tell us a little about how the inspiration came for your business and what it is?
Well, Tad, as I was saying to you, I describe myself as a professional avoider of housework. And sort of my daughter said, you're only happy when you're planning a holiday, Mum. And both Carol and I were exchange students in Japan a long time ago, so we love Japan. And we've sort of noticed that a lot of people originally weren't that sort of interested perhaps in travelling to Japan. They thought it was expensive and whatever. But we'd read about the pilgrimage trail that's in Japan. So we organised for a group of people to go, and they all loved it. So I thought, well, perhaps this is something we can do.
That trail is the sister trail to the one in Spain. What is it called?
It's called the Camino Codo. So it's the only pilgrimage trail that's recognised by UNESCO as a pilgrimage trail other than the Camino in Spain.
And you did that, Fiona, right?
Yes, I did that in around about late May or June of last year and loved it.
Right.
I mean, I am a hiker, but it was just a spectacular trip. And the thing I love about Japan is there'll always be a moss-covered rock and there'll always be a vending machine somewhere. And you can find that on the Kamano Kodo Trail. It is stunning.
Right. And how often do you organise groups to go and
We just organise twice a year. So we try and sort of take two or three tours back-to-back in April for spring cherry blossoms and then again October, November for autumn leaves, which are beautiful in
Japan. So have you just gone?
We came back on Saturday. We were away for 30 days and we'll go again October, November. So that's great for us. We get to go to Japan twice a year and we love it.
It's incredible how the cherry blossom season just is so huge over there. It's like it's a rite of passage, isn't it, really?
And the good thing is, you know, because it warms up south earlier, no matter where you're travelling, you can usually see cherry blossoms somewhere.
Yeah, like they're late this year, and people think, oh, we've missed them. No, I mean, all three groups saw cherry blossoms. It got to the point like, oh, another cherry blossom. But, you know, you can pretty much see cherry blossoms from mid-March right through to the end of April, depending on
where you are.
Yeah,
right.
That's great.
That's cool.
But I think the interesting thing about Japan, of course, is that everyone knows so well Kyoto and Tokyo and Osaka, but to specialise in regional Japan is a whole other experience. I mean, you start your tours sometimes in Koyasan.
That's right, and Koyasan is a mountain about an hour south of Osaka, which is the home of Shingon Buddhism, and so we take our group up there and we spend a night in a temple, and we eat vegetarian cuisine, and it's very atmospheric. It's beautiful, and from there we travel on and start walking.
Yeah. You two are fluent in Japanese, right?
Carolyn's much better than I. We both spent a year in Japan as exchange students, but yeah, we can certainly. Carolyn can read and write, and
yes, and I've had some interesting conversations in Japanese where I've had to pull out vocabulary for things I didn't know I had. But yeah, we can get around quite well with our Japanese.
But I think the interesting thing to notice that you don't have to be fluent in Japanese to go to Japan. I think that's probably something that scares people off.
Not at all. You know, family members of mine have travelled in Japan with no Japanese, and you become very good at looking for the English signs.
Right.
The other thing you'll find is as soon as you pull out a map, people will rush to help you. They'll go out of their way to take you to where you've got to be. Yeah. So it's very easy to travel there.
Yeah, the Japanese are amazingly friendly. And as I say, if you stand there looking confused for a moment, someone always comes up to help and show you around. And I mean, I've had friends who don't speak any Japanese, have hired cars and travelled right around, you know, Kyushu doing all the onsens and have had no problem at all. Gone to bars, you know, fitted right in.
Yeah.
It is amazing. I've had so much help and assistance, you know, people rushing to catch taxis for you because you can't get one at the train station. They're extraordinary. And I did learn a lovely little language trick when I was in Kyoto. I was sitting in a little cafe and there was only one person sitting in the cafe and only one lady who was cooking and serving. And when she brought the food to us, we said, arigato. And then the guy sitting down said, oh no, in Kyoto, I have to tell you a little trick. You say, okini. Like bikini. Okini for thank you instead of arigato, because that's how they say thank you in Kyoto. And so for the next 5 days, we were just saying okini like crazy, and everyone loved it. They laughed. They were so impressed. I was wondering, in fact, actually what we were saying. People were so impressed. But it was a really nice little trick.
That's good. You do have to be careful, though, because in Japan, it is very structured in tradition and etiquette, and you know, the simplest thing, like, you know, pointing a chopstick at somebody while you're eating is just a no-go thing.
Yes, exactly. And this last trip that we've done, we've sort of made a note of all the extra little etiquette items we need to pass on. And before we travel, we try to meet our walkers and run through some of the basic etiquettes of being in Japan. But, you know, we do notice, and one of the big things is to not put your chopsticks in a bowl of rice vertically, because that is part of the ceremony to honour the dead when the rice bowl is put on the altar. So that's a definite no. And also waving your chopsticks around is no go.
Wearing the toilet slippers out of the toilet, not a good look either.
Oh my goodness, I swear the slipper confusion in Japan is so wonderful. It's like, oh my god, I've got the wrong slippers. It's really, it's a lot of fun.
And what we know is, because we're quite used to it, so we know the etiquette, but invariably someone travelling with us will do the wrong thing and they're mortified. But
do you set them up? Just watch
it home. No, that's a good idea.
We enjoy it, though. Watching those bright red toilet slippers walk around a nice big hotel foyer is quite funny.
Yes, with the word toilet plastered over them. You know, it's not discreet.
Yeah.
It is funny when someone, when a lovely, you know, Japanese person comes running after you, goes, no, wrong slippers. And you're like, oh my God.
I had a friend just told me the other day that they'd been there and they thought they did the right thing. They put down the blanket for the cherry blossom under the tree and they were really enjoying it, but they noticed everyone around them was laughing at them. And finally a little girl came up and said, you need to take your shoes off. Like, you don't sit on the rug even under the tree with your shoes on. So, you know, but you know, Japanese people don't mind on the whole pretty much what foreigners do. I mean, like things like talking on trains, and that is a no-no. And there's lots
on
of little things
phone.
We can talk about. You don't do that.
That's a definite no.
But I don't disagree with that at all. I think it gets a bit ridiculous.
I think it's a lovely way to be.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. We're going to hear more about Japan from Carolyn Ellison and Fiona and myself. I'm Tad. We're going to learn a lot more of what you do over there and the food and the traditions and culture. And
you're listening to a Joycast from GLD, TIQ community radio station, Joy 94.9.
In the studio today, we have Allison and Carolyn talking all things Japan. I just want to share a bit of a fun fact for you guys about the food side of things. But in 2011, Japan overtook France in the number of Michelin-starred restaurants that they have in the country, and has kept that title ever since, which is pretty amazing to think that that's... it's not amazing. It's not. It's easy to believe that, because with the fact that in Japan everything is so technical and, you know, perfection is something that's striven for in many sort of aspects of life. It makes sense.
Their pastries, they do pastries better than the French.
And the chocolate,
oh my
definitely.
Goodness. Yep. It's just overwhelming.
Yeah, they just love it, doing everything so well, and they do love the Europeans, so they love French food, and it's basically hard to get a bad meal in Japan.
Yeah. And we were talking before the show too that everyone thinks Japan is so expensive from a food point of view as well, but you still can get inexpensive food that's really good.
I mean, if you want to, you know, you can pay top price for something, but even just a basic, you know, sort of meal, it's no more expensive there than it is here, I don't think. People say Japan's expensive. I don't think it is at all.
Yeah.
You know, just a good meal, a basic meal, would be less than $20, you know, our equivalent.
Yeah.
And you can get such a range, obviously noodles, but, you know, the don dishes, so the crumb pork or tempura or something on rice, you know, and usually comes with your pickles and bowl of soup and rice or maybe a drink of tea or something. So it's actually pretty good value, I think, really.
Exactly. Even like the bento boxes and things like that you can get on the fly, you know, when you're wanting to take away quickly.
And on the train. On the train without buying your bento because it's just so exciting opening it up and eating all those morsels.
Well, the train stations themselves, I mean, you could spend hours looking in the food stores in the train stations because there is that Japanese custom of when you go to visit somebody, you have to take them a box of sweets or cakes or biscuits, so everybody is shopping madly before they get on the train.
And when you go home to your family and your office, you also take home the box of beautifully wrapped sweets or pickles from that region. So there's food everywhere.
It's a very visual thing too, the way it's displayed and perfectly set out and plated. It's incredible.
It's nothing to have sit down to a meal. You know, we've been hiking for the day. Everyone's in their hiking gear. You come back, have that beautiful bath. You change into your yukata, your sort of cotton dressing gown, and which is a bit of fun. And we sit down to this beautiful meal, which you should be having at some, you know, 5-star restaurant. And we're all sitting there in our yukatas. But it's nothing to have 12, you know, 16 beautiful dishes, all individually beautifully prepared, beautifully presented. It's just, you know, a feast for the eyes. It's just amazing.
Do you have a favourite dish?
I don't have a favourite dish, but one of the inns that we stayed at this time, one of the last courses the lady served, she's a brilliant cook, chef, was a little plate of sea bream that had been done like tempura and then broad beans that were stuffed with prawns and then on the side a little bowl of charcoal salt.
Right.
And what I discovered on this trip is when we have tempura in Australia, we often have the dipping sauce that you dip your tempura in, but often when we're served it in Japan, it's served with a flavoured salt. So we had green tea salt at one place and charcoal salt, and the salt
brings out
the flavour. Right. And I reckon that was my favourite. It was just beautifully presented on a green plate, and that was magic for me.
Mm. Yeah, no, they really know how to present things. Everything's done with such care.
Yes.
No matter what it is, care is foremost in everything they do.
It's interesting. I really love soba noodles, and that in itself, making of the noodle, is an art form.
Yeah.
And if, I'm sure you've seen that.
Well, one of the places we do two walks, the Kamano Kodo walk, and the other walk that we do is through the Nakasendo. That's the trail, the old trail from Kyoto to Tokyo. And the area that we walk through is famous for soba noodles, which is made from buckwheat.
Yep.
So obviously great for people who are gluten intolerant or whatever. But yes, and so they serve them hot and cold.
Yes.
And I don't think people here think of noodles always hot, but they're beautiful cold in the summer. Oh. So they're served chilled and you dip them in a sauce that has a little bit of the wasabi and the spring onion. And then they usually bring out a little bit of the, if it's a place that where they've made them, they usually bring out a little bit of the stock.
Yep.
That they have made the soba noodle in, and they serve that separate to you at the end.
I prefer them cold.
Yeah, so do I.
I think it's actually
better. It's very refreshing.
It is, it's good. And what about sake?
Well,
are making faces.
Well, my new drink this time was plum sake on ice. And
I have tried that. That is delicious.
And the other thing you find when we sit down to these multi-course meals, which is called kaiseki ryori, cooking, at the very beginning you'll get a little sake cup of a local alcohol, aperitif, which you do your cheers kampai with at the start of the meal, and often it's plum sake. So that's my new discovery.
I mean, sake is they often describe as rice wine. It's not actually a wine. It is brewed.
Yeah. It's distilled, right?
And they have these other things. It's like a whiskey called shuhei. So
it's
distilled from rye or barley or potato, sweet potato, and they'll serve that on the rocks or with hot water, or it's they'll call it highball.
Right.
Shuhei, so they'll have that like a citrus flavour or plum flavour or something. So, because particularly once you get out into the regional areas, it's not easy to get decent wine. In the cities, you can get decent wine now. That's not an issue, and not a lot from Australia, but occasionally you'll see the odd bottle of Jacob's Creek or something from Australia. But usually from South America. a lot of the inns that we stay at, some of them serve some great wine. Usually you're safer to stick with the sake or the beer. They have great Japanese beer. Mm-hmm. But a shuhei, or that sort of highball, is sometimes someone might say, oh, I don't really feel like a sake or beer, but something like that on the rocks with lemon-flavoured or plum-flavoured or yuzu, which is a great citrus that the Japanese have, really tangy, is really, really very refreshing and really nice. You can certainly get into those.
Some amazing produce that, you know, is really special, like calamansi, which is a Japanese lime. And, you know, that goes well with so many, especially chocolate, but there's so many things. And, it's quite interesting. You know, there's a bit of controversy with the Japanese food culture as well, obviously with whale meat and eating live seafood. And do you experience any of that when you're there or...
Well, look, a little bit. The Kumano Kodo, we finish at Katsura, which is the main tuna port for the whole of Japan, really. And there is actually a whale processing plant there. We haven't eaten the whale ourselves, but they still have a whale museum. And talking to one of the fellows, a local fellow that we were there last, he was saying, look, as a child, they didn't have meat, really.
Right.
So he was an older man, and they had did eat whale meat because it was sort of their... an alternative to meat. But he said, look, these days it's really not... He said he doesn't eat it anymore. Look, we've been served some fresh prawns and things, but not a lot of...
Live sort of things.
Yeah, live things.
Joy 94.9 has a huge range of programs available for podcast. In fact, Joy is one of the largest podcasting communities on community radio. If you haven't checked out our podcasting service, you're missing out. Visit joy.org.au, click on the podcast tab, and you'll find a list of Joy programs regularly sharing the best interviews, news, and reviews. There's tens of thousands of hours for you to enjoy, so check it out now, joy.org.au.
Speaking about everything Japan today, and we want to ask a few more questions about the travel side of it, and the walking tour that you sponsor two times a year, or not sponsor, but you take groups on. How far do you travel in between points or stopovers, and you know, how strenuous is it? Is it something that people need to be prepared for?
Definitely. We do two walks. One's the Kumano Kodo, the pilgrimage trail that we talked about before. Yep. And on that, the trail itself, we only walk about 70 k's if you walk the whole way. We do have options, because there's two of us, we can split the group, and you know, one group can take an easier option, one group take the harder option. Yep. But that walk, we're dictated by in our days by the accommodation, because it's regional Japan. A lot of people have left to go to the city, so there's not a lot of accommodation. That's a difference to the Spanish Camino, for example. You can't just turn up. You do need to book in advance.
Right.
And so first day is only, it depends what you do, but it's about 4.5 k's. We just do an afternoon walk. And then next day, say 15.
Okay.
Next day is a bigger day, 22. So that's our biggest day for that walk. Next 2 days, they're only 15 k days the next 2 days. But it's reasonably solid, steep sort of hiking. So that one is a bit more of a hike. And we do say to people, you definitely need to train for that. And you do need to be prepared for some steep ascents and descents.
Right.
And, so people do need to train. But you are rewarded at the end of the day with those lovely hot spring baths, because it's an hot spring area. And we have the hot spring baths and obviously the beautiful food.
It really is a stunning way to end the day when you've been hiking all day, to have that hot spring and then a delicious sake. And back to the delicious dishes. Yeah. It really is heavenly. And then, of course, you sleep like a baby.
Yeah,
on the floor, on the lovely futon, and you get up the next day and get to do it all again.
Yes.
Yeah, if you're tired enough, you'll sleep on that pretty easily, I'd imagine.
Look, the beds are firm, and that's even in Western hotels in Japan, because they're traditionally used to sleeping on futons, people do tend to find even the Western beds pretty firm.
Right.
What I often am confused by is Japanese pillows.
Yeah. Okay.
Oh, God.
Well, they're stuffed with buckwheat.
Oh, they're really hard.
Yeah.
They're stuffed with buckwheat.
Which is what the soba noodles made from. So it is actually good for you.
It's environmentally.
Look, can I just say, some people, my husband actually says although you don't like it when you first start, it's a little bit like when you wrapped those babies up and they couldn't move. You put your head on that pillow and it's sort of locked there into position.
That is true.
And you actually sleep really well, because you can't wake yourself up. And it is surprising. People start the week not liking it. By the end of the week, they're converts to it. But just a little trick. If you go to a Japanese hotel, you'll usually find that the pillow has two sides. One side is the lumpy buckwheat side. The other side is a softer, more traditional, like the memory foam, you know, softer right. pillow side.
Oh, that is
they
a good
met,
trip.
And in one of the hotels we went to this time, you know, Western Hotel in the bigger cities, they actually gave you two pillows with four different sides, if you know what I mean.
Oh, yeah.
So
oh.
you had lots of choice.
Options.
Yeah.
That's
now,
good.
We were talking before about the differences when you are booking accommodation of how the... I mean, you can book Western accommodation, Western beds, or, of course, Japanese-style futons. But even within that, there is some things to watch out for if people are booking rooms.
That's right. And one of the things we've found with booking Western hotels, you might get, if you're going through booking.com or hotel.com, the option of a double bed or twin beds, but you need to pay attention because if that bed's called a semi-double, it's really a glorified king single and not really suitable for two people. So the sites will have the bed width on there, so it's good to check. And there are certainly hotels that have larger double beds, but you might find yourself, two of you, squashed up close to the wall in a very cozy bed.
So the Japanese-style futon rooms are always so delightful and peaceful. I mean, I just recall a very beautiful one I stayed in Koyasan in one of the monasteries that was just so peaceful. I did not want to leave.
Yeah, look, definitely. And I think if you're going to Japan, try and include a night at least in a traditional accommodation. So the ryokan is the more sort of expensive, I suppose, experience where they would normally lay out the futon for you, for example. There's a few little subtle differences. Or you can have the cheaper style Japanese inn, which is called a minshuku. So you can pay, you know, $1,000 a night, but you can also pay more like $100 a night to stay in a very nice ryokan, and it usually includes breakfast and dinner. Often you'll find, particularly in smaller places, you can't go out and have a, you know, pizza down the road. You do need to buy what they call half board, so breakfast and dinner included. And you want to do that because the meal is great and you can stay in and enjoy that.
I've been wandering around the streets of Kyoto and Tokyo in the morning trying to find breakfast, going, this is not working out for me. I really need to book breakfast, which is one of the interesting things I found, that in the big cities, Airbnbs were not as satisfying because the hotels have such fantastic buffet breakfasts.
Yes.
Yeah. And obviously to do the ryokan, you can do that. I mean, you can buy breakfast out, but the Japanese tend to be late starters.
Yeah.
You may not be able to get breakfast, which they will describe as a morning set.
Right.
So, you know, an egg and ham, or you can get a Western-style morning set, but you may not be able to get it till, say, 9 o'clock, which might be a little late if you're sort of planning to be
if
on the road
traveling.
And doing things. Yeah.
Right. And just getting back to the traveling in between the different points that you stop at, are you carrying all your belongings with you, or does it...
No, we have our luggage shuttled, especially on the Kanano.
Okay.
We have it shuttled
right,
each day.
Okay.
So you leave your suitcase out in the morning and it's waiting for you at your destination. The only thing we always say to people when they're travelling in Japan is the train systems don't have really facility for big suitcases.
Right.
So we encourage people to travel light because the Japanese will often forward their suitcases on from one city to the next at a very low cost. It's called Takubin, and it arrives the next day and it will have cost you less than $20 to forward it on.
Yeah. Traveling light is, you know, I would highly recommend to anyone who thinks about, really, you pack too many things?
I do,
You should come traveling with me.
Really?
I'm the light traveler in Japan.
I'm a pretty good one. I actually photograph my luggage before I get on a plane and just put it on the social media sites and just see how many people say, oh my golly, you can't be serious.
My brother's an airline pilot and he can travel in a little duffel bag for like a week and I just do not know how he does it. Seriously, it's crazy.
I'd probably pack a bit heavy too, but that's why. Look, so we just have a backpack and have the suitcase shuttled.
Right.
I mean, when we do the Nakasendo walk, which is the other walk, which is longer, we walk about 100 k's over, you know, 7 days on that. Some days are 20 k's, some days are only 8 k's. But we don't have our luggage shuttled every night, but sort of there's a couple of nights where you just take an overnight in your bag, which is, in Japan is great because everywhere you stay in Japan, they provide great toiletries.
Mm.
You always get your toothpaste and toothbrush. You often get a comb. If you're just changing into your yukata for dinner, you really need nothing when you get there because they've provided you with your towel. You know, in the bathrooms all have shampoo, body wash, all that sort of stuff. I mean, they're very civilized, the Japanese.
Yeah.
It's a great place to travel.
And they're very accommodating with, or very, you know, the attention to detail with everything is just incredible. So it's quite different from that point of view. And even like the bullet trains and, you know, the rail systems, it's like clockwork.
They announce if a train's going to be like 30 seconds late, it's announced in Tokyo. Yeah. Like,
imagine that.
And if you if a train comes in and it seems like it might be 1 minute early, don't get on that train because that's actually not your train.
Right.
Because your train is coming 60 seconds later.
That's right.
I made that mistake a few times.
Well, so did some girls after they left us, because they sort of say, oh, now we're out on our own because we haven't had to think for a week. We've been travelling with you guys. We told them, you know, we'd bought their tickets, they had their train tickets, but they got to the platform, they just got on the train there, and then the train had moved off, and then they realised, oh no, our train was 2 minutes later.
yes.
It was all fine, because in Japan nothing can go wrong. Like, you have to, even like losing something, you have to work hard in Japan to lose something, because people want to get things back to you. You know, you leave an umbrella somewhere, that will be there the next day. You know, it's an amazing place like that.
Yeah, that's great. Coming up next, we're going to talk about some recommendations for LGBTI travelers and what it's like in Japan, and
maybe talk about when the best time of the year to travel.
The best times, absolutely.
Australia's most amazing gay and lesbian radio station, Joy 94.9.
Welcome back to the Escape Hour with Fiona and Tad. This hour's going quick.
It certainly has, and of course, because I'm planning on going back to Japan in September again, I am so excited because it's just getting me all like ready to go.
Is that a good time of year to go?
Well, I mean, I think that there are probably lots of different times in Japan. I think perhaps, as we were saying a little earlier, is what time of the year is best not to go.
Well, look, you're right. There's so many good things about Japan, but probably if you can plan to not go in July, August, it does. It is very hot and humid.
Yes,
Kyoto very is humid. Very humid indeed.
Yep. Yeah, and I think people don't realise that. But I sort of sometimes say to people, "Would you go to Darwin in January?" It is very hot and humid. Yeah. I mean, and if you're going then you might plan to go to places like, you know, Hokkaido or up into the mountains where you're avoiding that humidity in particular. It might still be warm, but if you can avoid the humidity, a place like Koyasan that we go to is you know, more pleasant in the humid months.
And you probably also want to avoid the peak holiday times of the year, which where one is now. It's called Golden Week in May. Mm-hmm. And I flew out last Saturday night from Tokyo, and the plane was full of Japanese people heading off for a week off.
Right.
There's three public holidays in Golden Week, so it's always probably good to avoid that week. And also Oshogatsu, which is Japanese New Year. Most people will go home to their families for celebrate the end of the year, the start of the new year, and can be very difficult getting on a train then.
When is Japanese New Year?
Our New Year, 31st,
okay.
Same.
Okay.
Yes.
But traditionally, those first 3 days were always, everything was shut. It's not so bad now. The shops are still open. But generally speaking, it's not a great time to go because a lot of things will be shut sort of that first, second and third January.
Especially in, I've travelled around Japan at New Year, and in the country towns, very hard to find somewhere to have dinner if you're not staying at an inn. Hard to get on the bullet train. You can queue up for the unreserved seating, but probably, yeah, a good time to avoid if you can.
August the 15th is also a big time, so it's sort of that very end of April, beginning of May, which is Golden Week, as Carol said, that sort of middle of August, and then at New Year.
Right, that's interesting. And as far as LGBTI travellers, what recommendations would you have? I mean, I think, as we were talking about earlier, that it's quite accepting for travellers, but it's a little bit different if you're a local or living there. It's not
exactly. I think people perhaps, if you know, if they might have done a bit of reading, might think, you know, Japan isn't the most accepting place.
Yeah.
But I think that's probably more for locals. And I mean, Japanese generally, they're anything that's regarded as different isn't well accepted, and so they are very conformist. So people in themselves, you know, gay LGBTI people probably haven't been so well accepted, but I think it's different for foreigners, and that goes across the board for lots of things. For example, people with tattoos aren't allowed in baths, but they do understand that foreigners might have a tattoo and a little more accepting of that.
Right.
And so the same, I think, for travellers. I mean, Carol and I travelling together, just anecdotally recently, you know, went to book into a hotel in Nagoya. We'd booked a twin room. We were asked when we got to reception, you know, would you like a double room?
Yeah.
And I just thought it might have been their way of just, you know, two females
breaking
travelling.
The ice.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So I don't think it's an issue. I mean, Japanese are quite conservative. They're not people who display, you know, public affection, regardless, you know, their sex. And I think it's a good place to travel. You probably just need to be aware of things like that, that they don't, they're not a people who display affection, that you're not going to see, even when we meet the innkeepers who we know really well now. We would be a little, you know, some of them who've travelled to Europe, they might come and give you a hug.
Right.
But generally speaking, it's still a bow.
It's reserved.
And you can, you know, enthusiastically bow and hi and, you know, whatever. But it's just a little bit different like that.
Right.
Yeah, there's not a lot of physical contact.
Yeah.
Displayed. Yeah.
Yeah. Which is
not in public.
Yeah. And that, I guess just knowing that is beneficial, because that way it's not going to cause a problem. If,
yes.
You know,
But do you have a favourite region in Japan, or you?
Well, we both love the country, I think, just because it is different to the cities, and you just see a different side of Japan. I mean, Carolyn's travelled more than I have throughout Japan. What would you say is your
favourite? Yeah, look, I do love the country, because the level of the hospitality is terrific, the respect for each other, and we always have on a tour, the walkers always say, we didn't know Japanese countryside would be like this, and lovely little experiences where one of our walkers this time, his shoe broke, the sole came off his boot, and we're at Koyasan, and the walker said, oh, well, let's find a shoemaker. Well, there are no shoemakers in Koyasan, and we were thinking, how are we going to deal with this? And we walked past like a little backyard car repair man, and one of the walkers sort of waved, and the next minute the fellow was out with a drum, and he had the fellow's boot up there, and he was cleaning it out, and he glued it, and there's lots of high-fiving, and they didn't speak English, and our walkers didn't speak Japanese, but they got the job done, and I think they all walked away and said, wow, that was so kind. And we love it when our walkers have those sorts of experiences.
Yeah. It's hard not to have those experiences too in Japan, because they happen all
every,
the
around
time.
Every corner.
Around every corner, absolutely. People are so welcoming, and you are always, I don't know whether you should be surprised, but you do find yourself sort of marvelling.
Yes.
And, you know, you just, I mean, want to go back, I find. That's the exciting thing about travelling through the country. There's areas like Kyushu, which are much further away from the city areas.
And probably less foreigners travelling around Kyushu. I lived in Kyushu for a year, and it's a beautiful place.
Great onsen.
Great onsen.
Fantastic onsens.
Especially a little town called Yufuin, which I did go back to after a 10-year break, and I was a bit disappointed because it had become quite commercial. But again, up in the mountains, lovely onsen.
I mean, has Kumamoto recovered well from the earthquake, I wonder, that was there a couple of years ago?
I haven't been to Kumamoto recently, but they do, they're very good at recovering from that sort of thing. Like, you know,
have you ever experienced an earthquake while you were there?
My daughter was actually about 50 k's away from the earthquake when it happened. She was working in a ski lodge. Didn't realise how bad it was at the time. But I think that particular, you know, the area around the earthquake obviously is still recovering, but all around, like the ski lodges are, you know, back operating, you know, and everything's back to normal. There's still, like, little things, for example, we've noticed they make a point of saying that this seaweed's from Korea, for example. Sort of, there's obviously a bit of concern with amongst the Japanese themselves that their food might not be contaminated.
Right, which is interesting. And, I mean, for you know, an island like that, they just get it all, don't they? You know, if it's not a tsunami, it's an earthquake or a typhoon or something. And when they get hit really hard. And like you say, they're very resilient in recovering from that pretty quickly.
And they know how to deal with it. Like, their buildings are all built, you know, and the bullet train, all that sort of stuff is really well, they're very well prepared for it.
Yeah.
Like, all the, you know, low-lying areas now will have the, they say how far above sea level they are and which way you should be running if there's a tsunami or that sort of thing. So they're very emergency services are
prepared.
A
but even the buildings, you know, like the level of requirement for earthquake protection, you know, the buildings built on rollers or some of them sitting on these pistons and things like that that can accommodate for movement is just incredible. The ingenuity that goes into that, which is pretty, you know, obvious to the way that the Japanese culture is. But it's fascinating as well. Like, the, you know, they're able to build these huge skyscrapers in Tokyo, and it's a major earthquake zone, you know.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think there's a lot of rebuilding going on now in Tokyo. I noticed this time, I think, with the Olympics coming up.
Yes.
They're starting, and they've got the Rugby World Cup in 2019. So there's a lot of things that are happening with Japan, and there's a lot of the bigger train stations. There's a lot of renovations going. So I think they're really determined that they're going to have the city top-notch well before the Olympics.
Ready to go. Yeah. When are the Olympics on?
2020.
Right.
And right then around the corner.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, so they've got a few things coming up. And you're talking about, you know, small towns like where we walk through with the Nakasendo Walk. They're all these gorgeous little, like samurai sets, little tiny little wooden buildings. And some of them have had to be rebuilt because obviously fire was such an issue, you know, last century in particular, a lot of timber buildings. But these places are beautifully preserved now, and it's just such a delight to walk down those streets, and you feel like you've taken back to a little samurai set. And they just move on. If fire goes through, they rebuild, they preserve it.
Interestingly, I also found that traditional Japanese farmhouses, which normally they don't actually pass down, or they don't sell them, and if nobody in the family wants them, they just let them go into decline. And I recently was able to experience living in one of staying in one of these beautiful farmhouses because they the family had allowed a young couple from the area to go in and renovate and fix it up, this beautiful like 300 year old farmhouse that was completely traditional, except it had a new bathroom, of course, but so you can have these wonderful experiences in regional Japan that will just take you out completely of what you would from Tokyo to there in a couple of hours.
Yeah, and we always, if we've got somebody coming walking with us who's not been to Japan before, we always encourage them to go to Tokyo or Kyoto beforehand, just so that they experience both sides of Japan. And and the big cities are very exciting.
Yeah, there's a lot to see and do.
Absolutely.
Coming up next, we're going to ask some final questions about Japan, and we're also going to talk about our radiothon show for next week.
You're listening to a Joycast from GLBTIQ community radio station, Joy 94.9.
Well, here we are again talking all things Japan at the Escape Hour, our favourite travel and delicious travel and food show with Tad, myself, Fiona, and of course Carolyn and Allison from Kamaru Kumino. We were just asking quickly before about money in Japan. I know they have a lot of zeros, and I've often made the mistake of buying something and thinking it was $16, but it wasn't $160. Maybe give us a little bit of a rundown on that.
Look, just firstly, I suppose it's a funny country in the sense that it's a decentralized economy, and so cash is still king in a lot of places in Japan. Good idea to take a fair amount of cash with you. You'll be surprised a lot of little places, even in touristy areas, do still expect cash. They don't take credit card or FPOS. I was talking to Tad about that earlier, and just access to cash, your credit, your FPOS card won't be accepted everywhere, but it will be accepted at places like 7-Elevens, strangely enough, and the post offices. So just be mindful of that wherever you're travelling.
Yeah, that's really good tips, because that's the one thing you don't want to be left with is cash, obviously.
Yes, and it's amazing with such a technological society as Japan. Cash really
definitely
is king, absolutely.
And where can people find more about what you offer, your website?
We do have a website. Yep. It's only Carolyn and I, it's just a very small little concern. We've got a website, www.kamano.kamino, so kumano.com.au. Our phone numbers are there, and you can email us. We're always very happy to talk about Japan. And you don't, you know, we just love Japan. So yeah.
Well, thank you so much for coming in today and sharing all your knowledge. We really appreciate that.
Well, that's our pleasure.
Yeah, we'll have you on again sometime. We'll talk.
Oh, we'd love to come
Japan
and talk again.
And next week we've got our big radiothon show. We've got
exciting
Tony Tan, the chef, coming in, and we're going to share some of our own experiences as to why we want to be involved with Joy, and hopefully we get a lot of people signing up in the memberships. And
that's right. We're going to have some competitions as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
No, you can't win a trip to Japan, but you might be able to win something else, a little bit smaller.
But still, it's still winning something, which is important. And thank you again to Paul for helping us out with the tools today. And you know, it's going to be a great week with again just all the radiothon shows coming up and all the special events and the fun things and hearing people's stories and sharing a lot of that, which is going to be important and hopefully inspire people to become members and to donate and mm-hmm. and to make it all a big better place, which is what Joy 94.9 is about. Until next week.
Have a good week.
The Escape Hour, the podcast, is proudly sponsored by La Spaghettata. Over 30 years of food, family, and fun at 238 Lygon Street. Why not try them today? Look for the rainbow flag or call 9663 6102. Visit laspaghettata.com.au or find them on Facebook.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA plus community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.